Welcome to Coastal Cafe. I'm Aaron Barnett, your host today. Coastal Cafe is a joint production of Washington Sea Grant at the University of Washington's College of the Environment and KPTZ 91.9 FM. We are honored to have on Coastal Cafe today Commanding Officer of Naval Air Station Whidbey Island, Captain Matt Arney, to discuss past contamination and cleanup activities from compounds related to flight operations at the station. Captain Arney is a 1993 graduate of the United States Naval Academy, as well as the Darden School of Business at the University of Washington, where he received a Master of Business Administration degree. He is also an accomplished flight officer for the F-14 Tomcat and F-18 Hornet planes. Welcome to Coastal Cafe, Captain.
Thank you, Aaron. It's good to be on your show. I appreciate the opportunity.
Well, thank you. I have a quick question for you. Are F-14s and the F-18, are those fighter jets?
They are. The F-14 was the F-14 Tomcat from Top Gun fame and decades of service. And the F-18 is, they're both strike fighter aircraft in the end, though.
Okay, thank God. I had to get that out of the way. I was curious.
Yeah.
So we're going to be discussing some contamination issues from PFAS compounds, but I wanted to go into a little bit of the history of Alt Field and Naval Air Station Whidbey. Would you mind talking about that for a little bit?
No, that'd be my pleasure. It's a great place to start the conversation. And really, I could take it back a little further than that. You know, the Navy's been around the Puget Sound since the 1800s, Puget Sound Naval Shipyard being constructed in 1891. But then it was in the 1920s that we really saw naval aviation coming into the area. And so with the construction of NES Seattle in 1922, and that was actually the site of the first aerial circumnavigation of the globe that ended there in 1924.
So, is that the facility now Magnuson Park?
That's right. Over there at Sandpoint. That's right. Okay. That was, we ended up vacating that later on. And so really NAS Whidbey Island came from the operations there at Sandpoint at NAS Seattle, because it was decided in the summer of 1941 to construct a base for rearming and resupplying the float planes that flew out of there. And so that's what originated the seaplane base, what we call it now. And then shortly after that, a few months later, they decided to also construct a base for land-based aircraft, and that's what has become Alt Field.
So how long have you been the commanding officer there?
So I've been here about 3 years now. It'll be 3 years this summer. It's been really great. This is my first tour up in the area. I'd flown in the F-14 and the F-18 into Whidbey Island a couple times for what we call a gas and go, but this is my first time living up here, and it's an extraordinary area to live in. Great community and a great region to be a part of.
I'm glad to hear that. So what is the current primary and secondary mission functions of NAS Whidbey?
We have a couple primary platforms that we operate out of here, the P-8 Poseidon and the E-18G Growler. So it's the Maritime Patrol and Reconnaissance and the Tactical Electronic Attack Platforms. We also have the Navy Ocean Processing Facility that does the undersea surveillance for the West Coast. And then there's also a clinic. There's a fleet readiness center where they repair the parts that come off of the aircraft and a bunch of other entities. So ultimately, we've got just under 9,000 active duty service members here and 2,100 civilians and contractors as part of what we call Team Whidbey. So over 10,000 people serving on the base here daily.
So I understand that lately, in the last few years anyway, there's been some efforts to clean up some contaminated sites and groundwater. Could you talk about some of those contaminated site cleanup efforts that you've been working on? And a little bit
certainly.
The compounds and what they're for?
Yeah, Aaron, absolutely. It goes back to that history of NAS Whidbey Island. So I talked a little bit about what originated the base, but we continued flying seaplanes until about 1965. But as I said, we also built the land-based aircraft portion, which is Alt Field. So that was in the 40s. And so since the 40s, we've been operating everything from Hellcats and Wildcats to the A3D and the A6 Intruder. And so decades and decades of flying aircraft out of here. And also importantly, in that kind of World War II and post-World War II time frame, there was a lot of gunnery training that was going on as well. And so when we look at what we have to clean up from, is from those decades of when really society didn't understand what society was doing to the environment, what our society was doing. So when we had aircraft that leaked fuel, or where we had people who accidentally leaked stuff, then that was probably just that they let it go and let it go wherever it went. When we did the gunnery training as opposed to how we do it now, there wasn't a lot of effort in doing lead cleanup and other kinds of things. So it's really those decades of practices that we are now working to mitigate and restore as much of this as we can.
So not only are you dealing with stuff that came from anti or de-icing fluids, but you're dealing with explosives and petroleum products as well. I did not know that.
Yeah, certainly. You know, when you look at the entirety of what NAS Whidbey Island is, so when you look at all field and seaplane base, that's 7,000 acres of land there. And then when you add Lake Hancock down to the south, which used to be a bombing range, which we did inert rockets and bombs and strafing. And then you have Olap Coopville, which is one of the 18 outlying fields that we had constructed in World War II. Some of those have been converted to regional airports like Skagit Regional Airport. So you've got those four entities on Whidbey Island. And then we also have the Navy Weapons Systems Training Facility down in Boardman, Oregon. So in total, it's 70,000 acres of land, over 70,000 square miles of airspace that we train in. But those 7,000 acres that make up Altfield and Teaplane Base also have 15.5 miles of coastline. So it's a lot of area that's been affected by those decades of practice. And like you said, there's petroleum and oil and lubricants. There's the PFAS from the firefighting foam. There's the lead and other things from the inert ordnance and the bullets. So all those things wrap up into the program that we're working through.
In addition to lead, what other sort of contamination and impacts can come about from unexploded ordnance?
We have a program called the Munitions Mitigation Program. And so when we look at, for example, down at Lake Hancock, there's some of the, you know, even though they were inert rockets, there were fuels in there. And some of the, just my experience with inert ordnance and training ordnance, you also have like spotting charges. So you have some other, maybe some phosphorus chemicals and things like that. But, you know, that's just kind of going off of my experience. But the things that our munitions mitigation program really focuses on are those kind of fuels and the lead and those kinds of things that came out of those munitions.
So how do you guys find and identify and clean up ordnance?
Well, this is really focused on two areas. There's Lake Hancock. When I just look at the Whidbey Island part of the installation, Boardman has got a lot going on and a lot of really interesting stuff with its history with the Oregon Trail. But I'm going to keep the conversation focused on Whidbey Island. So down at Lake Hancock, where you have those things, periodically, some of that ordnance will just rise to the surface. And so about every 5 years, we go down there and do more cleanup. We also have an area at Pawnell Point over in Crescent Harbor that used to be used for some of the ordnance activities. So there's been occasional cleanup efforts over there. And then on Altfield itself, it's on the west shoreline, is where the gunnery training was. That's where we have the kind of lead residues from some of the old bullets and stuff that we trained off of. So those are the focus areas. So when we talk about Altfield, it's really the lead over there. And then Lake Hancock, it's a lot of the ordnance.
So let's move on to petroleum. I'm just going to go down the list of these three main categories here. So how have you guys been addressing past petroleum contamination, you know, identifying and finding and cleaning it up? What does that look like in your area?
There's two aspects to our environmental program. And at some point, I also want to talk about the team that we have going who really are a bunch of professionals working through this. So, but when we look at petroleum, a lot of the infrastructure, for example, under the tarmac, a pretty expansive ramp that we have here now, but the stormwater infrastructure was built decades ago. And so we've identified areas that we have some of the sediment that builds up in the stormwater system as some of those old petroleum and oil and lubricants that that had been coming off of the operations that gets in the sediment in the stormwater system. So we go through a clean inspect and repair process where we'll contract a service to come in to try to run cameras down, identify where problem areas are, and then try to bring that stuff out. We just don't push it out. We try to pull it out and then appropriately handle that material so that we're not just pushing it out into the environment. And that's really the two aspects to the environmental program. One is to make sure that we don't further release those kinds of things. We are a permitted organization, so we have EPA permits that we have to comply with, and we certainly want to comply with, and so we don't want to discharge anything. And then the other aspect of that is the cleanup. So there's making sure we don't discharge from current operations, including our cleanup efforts, and cleaning up under the CERCLA program those things that we've talked about from the previous decades.
Have you had to do much cleanup outside of U.S. Navy property?
So under that CERCLA program, the Comprehensive Environmental Response Compensation and Liability Act. So I think it's important to talk about that a little bit, Aaron. And, you know, this was, just as a reminder for listeners, this was kind of out of the realization through the 70s of the bad societal practices of managing hazardous chemicals and materials. And so in 1980, the CERCLA Act was passed. And so we certainly fall under that. So we are on the national priorities list, the NPL that EPA manages. And so as part of that program, a lot of the cleanup that I'm talking about under CERCLA has been on the installation to do that cleanup effort. There is off-installation activity, which is under PFAS, which we should also absolutely talk about, and the origin of the PFAS issue and what we're doing there. And so that's really where it gets to the focus on off-installation cleanup.
Well, welcome to Coastal Cafe. I'm Aaron Barnett, your host today. Coastal Cafe is a joint production of Washington Sea Grant at the University of Washington College of the Environment and KPTZ 91.9 FM. And today we're talking with Captain Matt Arney, commanding officer of Naval Air Station Whidbey Island, and discussing some of the environmental issues they've been dealing with over the past few decades. So, Captain Arney, I have one more question about petroleum. I don't know how it's measured when it's removed. Do you have any idea how much petroleum products have been removed from CERCLA from Superfund cleanup activities?
I don't have a number for you on how much has been removed. You know, the CERCLA process is a very long process. It can take 20 years, and it's got like 8 different steps from that original identification to all the way through that long-term management of the program. And so I don't have a number for you, but I can tell you that it continues today with those clean inspect repair projects in our stormwater system. And that's really when I look at petroleum, it's the making sure that, because our we still use, I can look out my window here at the office and I can see our fuel tanks, and we get our fuel by barge over on Seaplane Base, and it's pipelined over here. So it's making sure that the current petroleum products don't go into the environment as we work that cleanup effort. And in my experience, it's really focused on that stormwater when we look at the POLs, the petroleum, oil, and lubricants.
Okay. Well, this is a good time to start talking about PFAS then. Would you like to start the discussion on PFAS when you feel appropriate?
Yeah, absolutely. I wish you had a couple hours because there's so much to talk about with PFAS, but we'll boil it down, so to speak. So I think it's important to go out, you know, what the Department of Defense, the DOD, is trying to do. And there's really three things. It's mitigating and eliminating AFFF, which is aqueous film forming foam. And I'll talk real quickly about what that substance is. It's understanding the impacts of PFAS on human health and the environment. And it's also meeting our PFAS cleanup obligations. So PFAS, it's parent polyfluoroalkylene substances, I think. And so it's a broad category of many chemical compounds. The two that have the most visibility are PFOS and PFOA, which are the two that are that the EPA's lifetime health advisory for drinking water of 70 parts per trillion is based off of. And so where it comes from, you know, throughout society, of course, you can look at PFAS and it comes in many products throughout society. But here at the installation, we're focused on two aspects. One is AFFF, the aqueous film forming foam that we've used for firefighting. And then the other is our landfill, just like you can see other landfills across the state and the area that have potential for PFAS coming out of them because of what people put in those landfills, you know, decades ago.
Is your landfill on the installation then? Does the Navy have its own landfill?
Yeah, so we sure did, Aaron. We refer to it as Area 6. If you're coming to the installation, it's on the south side of Altfield Road. It was capped a while ago, and there was actual remediation effort that was started in the early 90s. And we continue, as I said before, CERCLA is a very long process, and we continue to work through that process as science evolves and we understand more about those things that are leaching out of landfills and how to remediate for those. So that effort continues today, but it's not an active landfill.
Now, how do you clean up the PFAS contamination on site and off site or wherever for that matter?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it's partly, there's a few methods, and those methods continue to evolve as the industry around PFAS evolves. One of those methods is incineration. We do not do that on site. That is something that we have to contract to have water with PFAS in it removed to a different location. But what we did do on site is we did a GAC treatment, granulated activated carbon, which is basically a big bit of water filter. And so we created a system to be able to clean, I think it was about 120,000 gallons of PFAS contaminated water from one of our hangars, because some of our hangars have AFFF firefighting systems embedded in them. So if there's an aircraft fire, there's a fire in a hangar, then we want that firefighting foam to be dispensed in the hangar environment to make sure that we're mitigating any possibilities of damage and certainly making it safe and to try to take care of all the people who work in the hangar. And so some of our hangars have those embedded systems. So there was one that was initiated. And so all that water was captured and we held it while we developed that GAC treatment facility. And so we worked through over a long period of time, kind of a pilot project to do that. But we also have another project that we are working with some technology out of Germany. And so we're working with a group called the Engineering and Expeditionary Warfare Center, EXWIC, and we're going to bring a pilot project here to use that German technology to do organic PFAS removal from PFAS contaminated water.
Organic removal, does that mean they introduce some sort of microbe or some organism that...
Bad choice of words. Bad choice of words for me on this. It's not organic from that standpoint. It's right. Organic as far as we do it on the installation ourselves. Okay. And because my desire would be to have a scalable system that we have on the installation as we continue to work through the current use of AFFF. And I think it's important to talk about why we actually still use AFFF as well.
That actually leads me to my next question, because I know that AFFF is used on ships where I've worked. I've used AFFF on vessels I've worked on, and I know it's very effective. Is there a alternative that's just as effective to replace something that's PFAS-derived, or is it still going to be a PFAS product?
Yeah, that's the key, as effective. AFFF was developed back in about the 50s or 60s, and it really is a superior product for combating fire, because what it does is it forms a barrier. So you dispense it. It's a concentrated substance that you inject into the firefighting system, and so as the water goes out, it combines with the PFAS. With the AFFF, which has PFAS in it. And so it goes out and it forms a foam. And so that foam forms a barrier. So when you think about fire, it needs the fuel, the oxygen, and the spark. And so when you can cut the oxygen out, then you can extinguish that fire. And then the other key part about AFFF is that it forms that barrier, which can maintain that protection for 30 minutes or so. And so you've got time so that you're less concerned about reflash as you continue to work through the problem and save lives and minimize damage. So one of the things that we are working towards as DOD and the Navy and many others is a fluorine-free compound, one that would not have those PFAS chemicals but could work as well. And you mentioned the shipboard environment. Obviously, when you're out there on an aircraft carrier, which I've spent many days and nights on, that it's very important to be able to control that fire. But even here, we need to be able to have a very good process to control a fire and save lives. So we are using a different compound. We are swapping out the compound. This one is supposedly not going to have the bioaccumulation that was a concern with the previous version of AFFF, but we are working towards having a fluorine-free compound that performs as well. And that's the key. The ones that are out there right now do not perform as well as the AFFF that we're now using.
So does your installation have any prevention measures put in place to contain it if it is used? Keep it from rolling.
Great question.
So to speak.
Yeah, and that was actually the next thing in my mind, Aaron. We do have processes. So if it's out there on the airfield, for example, on a runway, then we are obviously going to be focused on working the fire and the emergent situation. And our permits allow for that. And so we're going to dispense AFFF. Not in training. We don't ever do it in training anymore, but only in the event of an emergency. Once that emergency is complete, we have a team ready to go in and do that reclamation process to mitigate the possibility of it getting into the environment. And then the other area is the hangars, like I talked about, and our hangars have discharge systems that capture that AFFF so that we can then process it appropriately.
So it sounds like the Department of Defense is going at this with a two-fisted approach, where they're looking at alternatives to the past material and also putting in place containment, secondary containment. I think that's the right word. That sounds about right.
That's right. Secondary containment and then treatment processes to make sure that it's appropriately disposed of. And so it really does get back to those three priorities that we're working off from DOD. And as much as we'd like that fluorine-free, which the goal is to have that fluorine-free compound in a few years, but that circular process, like I said, takes a long time as we study the environment, understand the situation, and properly mitigate it.
Now, does de-icing fluid have similar compounds in it, or is that a completely separate animal?
Yeah, that's really a separate animal. We definitely use de-icing around here. We maintain with our maritime patrol and our cargo and transport aircraft the ability to fly in the wintertime at any time. And so we still use that, and we have appropriate processes to make sure that we are using the right substance that is permitted by appropriate agencies.
And that agency is like Environmental Protection Agency. Do you have to get permits from Washington State Department of Ecology?
We work very closely with the Department of Ecology on a lot of things, but the main permits being our MS4 Municipal Separate Storm Sewer System Permit and those kinds of things. Those mainly come from the EPA.
Well, we got about one more minute left. Captain Arnie, is there anything you'd like to add before we close?
I would really just like to emphasize the team here. We've got an extraordinary team at Whidbey Island and the environmental branch. And so, you know, they're highly diversified in their skill sets. They have a team that consists of engineers, both civil and chemical, biologists, archaeology, environmental health, safety, and conservation professionals. So their people are really knowledgeable and very dedicated to not only making sure that we can do the mission, but doing it appropriately and cleaning up from those decades of what we've been doing around here as a society. And then that's backed up by others in the region and contractors that we use for certain specialties as well. So it really is an extraordinary team out here at Team Whidbey, and I'm just really happy to be a part of it.
Oh, fantastic. It's been a pleasure having you on the show, and it sounds like there's some good headway being made. You know, in the face of some pretty big challenges that are hard to deal with.
Yeah, so, it really is. But, you know, it's really our pleasure to be a part of working through these challenges. And so thanks for having me on the show, Aaron. I greatly appreciate the opportunity.
So thank you all for joining us. This is Aaron Barnett, and you've been listening to Coastal Cafe, a joint production of Washington Sea Grant at the UW College of the Environment and KPTV 91.9 FM. Washington Sea Grant helps people and marine life thrive by providing research, technical expertise, and education that support the conservation of our ocean and coastlines. I'd like to thank our program director, Larry Stein, and production engineer, Jared Dufresne. And as always, a special shout out to the band Ku'ik for sharing their music with us at the open and closing of this program. Thank you for listening and have a great day. Hatuasiku ha, shingen ani. Hatuasiku ha, shingen ani.